I next met with Dr. Joan Schiller, and she began our conversation by presenting a patient from her practice.
So this is a 59-year-old Hispanic woman who had been in her usual state of good health until presenting with a 3-month history of cough and a 2-week history of hemoptysis. Workup revealed that she had a large 4-centimeter mass in the right main stem bronchus, about 2 centimeters distance from the carina, and she also had multiple enlarged right-sided mediastinal lymph nodes. The remainder of her workup was negative, and so she was staged as having a T3N2 stage 3A disease, which turned out to be adenocarcinoma. So here we treated her with weekly carboplatin and paclitaxel with concurrent thoracic radiation therapy, followed by 2 cycles of consolidation with standard carboplatin paclitaxel.
And how does she tolerate the therapy?
She actually tolerated it quite well. She had some dysphagia when she was getting the radiation therapy, but that cleared relatively quickly. She had no weight loss associated with it. She did have some fatigue, but overall tolerated it well.
Now, what type of testing was done, if any, on the tumor for mutations? And was she a smoker?
Yes, she was a smoker. We did not test her for some of the driver mutations because, once again, it has not yet been proven that they work in this stage 3 chemoradiation setting. Although, again, that is another very active area of investigation. Studies are going on now looking at it in that setting. I think there is a lot of debate in the field about when you test for mutations and whether or not they should be tested routinely. And the reason we do not is twofold, one of which is she may, in this setting, do very well and never need to be tested. She may be cured. And secondly is, in this situation where there's not a real lot of tumor, who knows what other mutations we may want to test for a couple years down the line. So the tissue's not going anywhere. Should she recur, in my mind, that would be a good time to test her off of a research setting.
I guess one argument that I've heard is that sometimes when people present with recurrent disease, you want to know the results of the mutation testing quickly. Maybe they don't want to wait for the results, that there might be some value in knowing that ahead of time. What do you think about that argument? And at your place, how long does it take you, for example, to get an EGFR or ALK back?
So the biggest issue is getting that darn tumor into the hands of the molecular pathologist. Once the tumor actually gets into the hands of the molecular pathologist, it's usually about 4 or 5 days to get the results. The biggest issue is simply getting it there, and particularly if it's at an outside institution, realistically, it can take a week to get it there. The other big issue is typically if it's a new biopsy, it first has to go to the anatomical pathologist to confirm that it really is cancer and it really is adenocarcinoma, and then to the molecular pathologist. That won't be an issue in this case.
One of the things that's interesting about this case is the consolidation chemotherapy that you gave her after chemo radiation. There's been a lot of debate and controversy about that strategy. It always seemed to make sense to everybody, but some people feel that there's not adequate data. What are your thoughts about this, and why did you use this kind of consolidation?
Use the consolidation based on the LAMP trial, which was, albeit a randomized phase 2, not a phase 3. But with the LAMP trial, the 3 arms involve concurrent weekly chemo radiation, as given here, versus 2 cycles of induction therapy, followed by the weekly carboplatin versus the weekly carboplatin radiation followed by the 2 cycles of consolidation. And in that randomized phase 2, it was that 3rd arm that won, that had the overall better outcomes. I think we have to differentiate when you're giving weekly carboplatin paclitaxel or really any weekly chemotherapy, you're giving it for radiation sensitizer purposes. You're not really giving it to clear micrometastatic disease. So that's why I think you need standard doses at some point of the chemotherapy.
OK, Can you talk a little bit about what the alternatives are in terms of chemo radiation regimens and why you favor the carbopaclitaxel?
So I think another alternative is clearly cisplatinum etoposide, which is the typical regimen that SWOG uses, and there it is given concurrently without any consolidation at the end. There they use standard doses given concurrently with radiation therapy, with the idea of both using it as both a radiation sensitizer as well as a systemic therapy all at once. My only issue with that is that that can be a tougher regimen because you're giving the standard doses of the chemotherapy with radiation therapy. And in general, those outcomes, and I know you can't compare studies unless they were formally compared in a phase 3 study, but in general, those data look roughly the same.
Let's talk about your 41-year-old patient. I see the patient was a physician.
So this is a 41-year-old never-smoker physician, a gastroenterologist, who was very healthy. She was the type of person that ran a lot and exercised and did absolutely everything correctly. And then, wouldn't you know it, she comes down with a one-month history of increasing shortness of breath, anorexia, feeling terrible, weight loss, and real interesting night sweats. I had not really seen that before, but pretty significant night sweats. And eventual workup revealed a right upper low mass, multiple pulmonary nodules, mediastinal adenopathy, adrenal met, numerous bone mets, and biopsy was positive for an adenocarcinoma. And so on this one, we did do molecular testing, and turns out she had an EML4 ALK translocation. And at the time she was diagnosed, the only agent that was available was crizotinib, which we started her on it. And she did very well for about 9 months. Her symptoms pretty much totally resolved. I don't think she went back to running her 3 miles a day, but she went back to quick walking her 3 miles a day. And that was for about 9 months. And then about 9 months later, started developing symptoms once again, including the night sweats. In addition, at that time, she had headaches. Repeat scans revealed not only did she have systemic progression of her tumor, but also new brain mets as well. So she underwent radiation therapy to her brain mets. And at that time, the clinical study that we had available to us was ceritinib, on which she's still on and doing quite well. She's once again had an excellent response. She's now about 18 months out. I think like many patients on ceritinib, I think personally it's not quite as well tolerated as crizotinib. And so she did have to have several dose adjustments as well, primarily for elevated liver function tests. But we were finally able to come up with a dose which she's tolerated. And as I said, she's doing very well.
Did she have any side effects? I've heard about GI problems with ceritinib.
Her major side effect was the LFTs that she had.
What have you seen in terms of other side effect issues with ceritinib?
I think other side effects include diarrhea, rash, and just not feeling well, more fatigue, more anorexia, just not feeling as well. But I think the biggest probably are the LFTs and the diarrhea.
This case brings up a couple of points in terms of things that I've heard about ALK disease. One is the propensity for aggressiveness. And in her overall presentation and course kind of falls into that platform. Is that your observation, that ALK disease tends to be, you know, more aggressive systemically and more likely to involve the brain?
Hard to say, I guess, because then you're comparing anecdotal responses with anecdotal, you know, responses type of thing. But you're right. When I think back upon the patients I've had with ALK disease, you're right. They tend to have had aggressive disease very similar to her. Whereas I guess the EGFR mutation positive patients probably have presented with more indolent disease.
Now, you mentioned she had radiation to the brain. What kind of radiation and where were the brain mets located?
So she had numerous brain mets all over, so she had whole brain radiation therapy. Now, I think one of the areas of interest is the fact there's another second-generation drug for ALK-positive patients, and that's alectinib. And I think there's a lot of interest in that because with alectinib in particular, there's data to suggest that it penetrates the blood-brain barrier well and is more effective in patients with brain metastases or preventing brain metastases.
And that's another thing I've heard in terms of maybe the lack of benefit that's seen in the brain with crizotinib. In this case, it sounds like she actually progressed both systemically as well as in the brain after 9 months. And she also had symptoms with nausea and headaches. Are there situations with ALK disease, and for that matter with EGFR mutations, where you have a patient with brain mets, they don't have symptoms, the mets are small, multiple mets, where you might try systemic targeted therapy and hold off on the radiation?
Yeah, I think that's true not only for the targeted therapies, but frankly also for chemotherapy. If brain disease in general is small and there's not a lot of lesions and you're not worried about them rapidly growing and the patient's asymptomatic and they've got bulky disease elsewhere, yeah, you can try some systemic therapy first.
It's interesting because I haven't really heard anybody bring up that question about chemotherapy. Have you seen actually objective responses to chemotherapy in the brain?
Not necessarily responses, but certainly stable disease while their systemic disease improves. So in some people, if they've got a lot of bulky systemic disease, that may be what needs to be treated first.
So this lady's now going 18 months now since she was put on sorafenib, but also since she had the radiation therapy. Have you been able to detect, or has she been able to detect, any CNS changes from the radiation therapy, any cognitive changes?
She has not, although that clearly was a major, major worry for her. But knock on wood so far, no. She's actually gone back to work as a physician again.
That's interesting that she's able to work with brain mets.
With a history of brain mets.
History of brain mets,
yeah.
Okay, right. What's the thinking right now in terms of the optimal sequence of targeted therapy in patients with ALK rearrangements? What discussions are going on right now about trial design? You know, kind of looks like these second-generation agents, and sorafenib is approved, and they seem like maybe they're more effective than crizotinib, but what is the thinking about optimal sequencing?
I think the obvious question is whether or not they should be used first before chemotherapy. And I think there, those trials to prove that are going on as well. I think most of us would use them first. Just as with the EGFR inhibitors, they tend to work so well, it's hard to see how they would not be at least as good as chemotherapy.
What about the sequence of targeted therapy in ALK disease? Is there any thinking about, for example, moving sorafenib or alectinib up front?
Absolutely. And those trials are ongoing to use them as first-line therapies.
Any thoughts about, you know, how it's going to play out? I've heard people say, well, maybe actually patients are going to end up being better off starting on crizotinib, then coming in with the next generation. In the long run, maybe that's going to be optimal. You have any thoughts about that?
I think that's a really good question. And again, those studies are ongoing. You can make the argument both ways, that you do want to use a drug like crizotinib and save additional therapies for later. On the other hand, you could also make the argument that these second-generation drugs are so good that you won't need a second-line therapy for much later than you otherwise would have. So I think you can argue it both ways.
In terms of tissue testing, this patient, I assume, had traditional EGFR and ALK testing. And although a lot of investigators, their centers for research purposes or practical purposes, are using multiplex testing or next-generation sequencing, what are your thoughts about the ideal way to test these tumors up front?
So that's, a really good question. And I know that many key opinion leaders say you should do the multiplex testing up front and automatically on all patients. I think that multiplex testing is a great research tool, but realistically, for most patients in the United States who are not going to a primary NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center, most of what is found on that is really not actionable. So again, great research tool. You can find a lot of miscellaneous things that you have no idea what to do with. There are other mutations other than EGFR and ALK which are potentially actionable. So those would include such abnormalities as BRAF, ROS, RET, HER2, PI3 kinase. So when we test, we do test for all of those, not just EGFR and ALK.
So let's finish out talking about your 69-year-old man.
So this is a 69-year-old accountant who presented with cough and hemoptysis, fatigue, and a 5-pound weight loss, all relatively quickly over several weeks. Workup revealed he had a large, bulky, 8-centimeter left-sided mass invading into the left main stem bronchus. He also had liver metastases and did not have bone or brain metastases. So he was staged as having an extensive stage disease and treated with 4 cycles of cisplatin and etoposide and did very well. He had a very marked reduction of his tumor, both in his liver as well as in his lung. So the question came up here as to whether or not to give him PCI, prophylactic cranial radiation, which we elected to do, based upon the studies which have shown that even in patients with extensive stage disease, if they have a very good partial response, they too may have a survival benefit.
He was a smoker?
Yes, he was a smoker.
And how did he do with the PCI?
Did fine. And so this was only about 6 months ago, so don't know what his outcome is going to be in the long run.
You know, we tend not to talk that much about small cell, at least until recently, and now it looks like maybe we have something to talk about. But what has come out over the last couple of years of, you know, any encouragement in terms of small cell, particularly with checkpoint inhibitors?
So you're right. Small cell lung cancer has been an orphan disease for a while now, but the NCI is just starting to get into it. And about a year or so ago, there was a conference for a variety of academic leaders. It was led by Charlie Rudin, who's now at Memorial, and John Minna. And it was a very extensive conference evaluating what we know about small cell. There was another conference earlier this summer, and based upon these two conferences, there may be the equivalent of a MAP trial coming out for small cell. So a trial in which patient's tumor is sequenced, and based upon the sequencing data, they then get assigned to the appropriate drug. One of the other areas that I think is also of a lot of interest, and this is based on relatively small amounts of data, is with the checkpoint inhibitors. And there was data that was presented at ASCO this year, which did show a response rate in these patients. So I think we're going to see a lot more interest there as well.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, I think about small cell, I think about smokers, and I think about, quote, a lot of mutational load, if you buy into that. Do you?
Right, exactly. So the data with the checkpoint inhibitors would suggest that it is those tumor types with a high mutational load, such as lung cancer, particularly in smokers. Small cell, being an aggressive disease, also has a high mutational load. Obviously, the other disease types include melanoma due to sunlight causing mutations. And these are the disease types that appear to be particularly amenable to this immunotherapy.
You mentioned the potential for targets and targeted therapy in small cell. Any particular targets that look promising?
Well, one target clearly was FGFR, the fibroblast growth factor receptor. I'm not sure which other drugs are currently being looked at in terms of specific mutations.
So one final issue I want to get your take on relates to treatment of wild-type metastatic non-small cell and an agent, ramucirumab, that's now approved in both squamous and non-squamous disease as second-line therapy with docetaxel, and also the EGFR antibody necitumumab. First, ramucirumab that we've been talking about for a while in our programs on gastric cancer. What do we know about this agent in non-small cell?
So this is a drug that is currently being used, as you mentioned, in gastric cancer. This was a randomized phase 3 trial using docetaxel plus or minus this drug in non-small cell lung cancer, which turned out to be positive for overall survival. So a second line trial, positive for survival. The other drug, of course, that was an anti-VEGF is bevacizumab. That was used in the first line setting. The American U.S. ECOG trial showed a survival benefit, whereas the European trial, which used a different chemotherapy combination, did not. Hard to say how to interpret the RAMI findings compared to bevacizumab. Also hard to kind of figure out where it's ultimately going to be in our armamentarium, given the fact that we have these checkpoint inhibitors coming down the line.
I guess one question I have, you know, sort of putting aside the checkpoint inhibitors or just even assuming you're going to try them, knowing that a lot of people might not respond, is the question of the patient who goes through first-line therapy and doesn't get bevacizumab. And I don't know right now how you're approaching first-line therapy of non-squamous cancers. Are you generally including bevacizumab if they're Bev eligible or not necessarily?
So, yes, we are. We're generally speaking using carbopaclitaxel and Bev or carbopemetrexed. And in my mind, those two are roughly equivalent, even though they have not been compared head-to-head.
And that, you know, we're hearing more people. That's why I kind of brought that up. That's what I thought about when I saw these ramucirumab data, because, you know, we are hearing people talk about, you know, for example, carbopem without Bev. What do you do with those patients second line?
Well, typically in the past, what we have done is give docetaxel. I strongly suspect we're going to be giving nivolumab very soon here. Yeah.
Right. But again, even if you give the nivolumab, most of the patients aren't going to respond. So what's going to be next is my question.
Yeah. So if not docetaxel, it's typically gemcitabine.
Well, I guess the question I have is at this point, you know, would you use docetaxel knowing there's a trial out there showing that there's an additional benefit by adding ramucirumab to the docetaxel?
Good question. The improvement in survival was relatively minor, at 10.5 months versus 9.1 months. Expensive drug. This is, I think, the type of thing that we are all struggling with in terms of keeping the cost of oncology care down. When is the benefit such that it is worth using an expensive drug?
Yeah, and you know, there was actually a paper, I think it was talking about raising the bar.
Yes.
You know, and they looked at lung and a couple other cancers in terms of how much benefit, you know, is justified. And I don't know that they got into cost, but obviously that's an underlying sort of theme there. Any thoughts about that? It does seem like there are a lot of trials in many different tumors nowadays where you see, because of the power of the trials, a statistical benefit, but that's clinically modest, as in this case.
Right, and the power of the trials in terms of the number of patients they put on to show that
right.
relatively small benefit. I think it is a very pertinent question that we are going to have to deal with, because we can't continue to have phase 3 trials that involve thousands and thousands of patients only to show a 4 to 6 week overall improvement in survival.
There was one other thing I was going to ask you about, because I asked you about this issue of EGFR antibodies, and I noticed your name was on a couple of papers that addressed that. I saw something this morning related to the FDA looking at nesetumumab. I'm not sure exactly where that's heading. Any thoughts about nesetumumab and about EGFR antibodies in lung cancer and where that might be heading?
So if we think that this drug, the RAMI drug, is having a problem, I think nesetumumab is going to have an even bigger problem. There, the magnitude of benefit was even smaller. And in general, the EGFR monoclonal antibodies have not been used in the United States. The trial in the U.S., which used it with carboplatin paclitaxel, was a negative trial, and the one in Europe was a relatively minor improvement trial.